Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We are on the second day of the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump today. It's funny. Yesterday, I was running a quick errand, and while I was, in the car, but not actually driving, I took out my cell phone and seeing if I could find a live feed of what was going on in the impeachment trial. And so I figured, Trump impeachment video feed, and with Google basically in so many words, which one? Which trial, right? So it's one of these things about, Donald Trump, which it's not the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Which one are you talking about? Which time when he was put on trial? And it's funny. In some ways, the whole thing, first time is tragedy, second time is farce. But here, obviously, the first impeachment trial is basically a farce. Although this one somehow more so, if only because I guess the first time sort of, kind of putting the Senate through its motions, putting the Republican majority through its motions. Like, do you really not care at all that this happened? Like, not at all, right? And now we know, right? I mean, we know that quite literally they do not care. And you have this additional thing that, round one, President Trump had sort of like a grab bag of lawyers. He had Pat Cipollone, his White House counsel, who is a very accomplished lawyer. You may not like him, but he's not a nobody. He's a pretty top flight lawyer. And then you had Alan Dershowitz, former top flight lawyer, now kind of clown figure, halfway to Rudy-dom, basically. And then you had, that guy whose name escapes me, the guy who's really involved in the evangelical politics and his sort of family business is this organization that basically is an advocacy group for, how the right sees religious liberty. In any case, they made their case and it kind of was what it was. And this time, President Trump, no one wants to touch the guy now. I mean, politicians cannot separate themselves from him, but lawyers who still want to get the big corporate work do not want to touch the guy for obvious reasons. And the first legal team he set up, he basically said to them that he, in essence, wanted to make an affirmative defense. So the election was stolen. So, of course, I'm going to do an insurrection. I mean, I'm the aggrieved party here. So those lawyers, and there was some discussion of maybe it was all also about money. Come on. If you sign up to, defend Donald Trump after his insurrection, after he's president, you're not doing it for the money. This is a career boost, fame kind of thing. In any case, those lawyers did not want to go into, whether it's technically a court or into the Senate, and basically lie on his behalf. So he got these other guys who are these kind of like ninth string guys, and it was a bit messy. Kind of got negative reviews even from the senators who have sworn a blood oath to acquit him no matter what. And even the arguments they were making were, it's funny, I listened to a lot of the, I guess his name's David Schoen, the second guy, making this argument, this sort of like highly technical, highly strained argument that when the Constitution speaks of how you try a president, it says president, not former president. Ergo, you cannot impeach a former president, even though you can impeach everybody else in the government. But then he had some reason why he couldn't do that. In any case, a very, very, let's call it a highly, highly textual and, I had the word at the tip of my tongue, and speculative theory. And it's funny, when I'm driving in the car, it just shows you how multitasking and talented I am. I'm driving in the car and I'm listening to this guy and I'm thinking, like, wait a second. By this guy's logic, when you impeach a president, because how it's supposed to work is you're impeached, you're put on trial, you're convicted. If you're convicted, the Senate can then vote again to bar you from office for life. But by his logic, once you're convicted and removed from office, the Senate is actually not allowed to do the second vote because now you're former president. And the Constitution says president, not former president. I mean, the whole thing is like so nonsensical. And have to imagine that the Republican senators there were a little chuffed about, you know, we agreed to exonerate you no matter what, but you're really putting us to our test here, this being so ridiculous, you know. And we have all the Trump era kind of headlines about Trump was extremely angry. President very angry, very, very, very angry, even screaming. And there was even like some headline I saw, almost screaming, which made me think like, I'm always almost screaming because I'm not screaming. I guess you could say I'm almost screaming. Like, I don't even know what that means.
Showing your scream.
Yeah. And so it was sort of like a flashback for me to the Trump era proper when, I mean, think about how much news coverage was President angry, super angry, or another sort of, you know, genre of Trump era reporting of, you know, kind of former, you know, someone who's his BFF, someone who he loves, you know, whether it's Nick Mulvaney or who's the general guy who was chief of staff?
John Kelly.
And then you see like, you know, first headlines, getting frustrated with Nick Mulvaney, not loving Nick. And that all, you know, leads to very angry, might fire him. And it just reminded me how much of coverage of President Trump was just these things about how angry he is in his mood, you know, this kind of, and like, you don't kind of see, I mean, you see, you know, you might see something like, you know, Biden very disappointed in this, Biden this. And we're pretty early in the Biden times. I mean, I guess this is the third week. But, you know, we're never going to see that as like a big thing. Biden's super angry. Was in his private residence yesterday, so, so angry. Even Jill was kind of freaked out. Very angry. So that's where we are. So we're gonna do this impeachment trial. And I guess the idea is, what, they're probably not going to be witnesses, but they've left open the chance that there could be witnesses. And obviously, unlike last time, it's the Democrats' call. They can decide to do witnesses. That's being run by them. I'm a little unclear. I mean, I don't think they would allow themselves witnesses and not allow the president witnesses. But this is the thing, as we saw in Trump impeachment 1.0, majority can kind of do whatever it wants. And there's been a number of interviews that with Lindsey Graham, where he's basically said, "Oh, you do witnesses, man. We're gonna bring in the FBI, bringing in the ice cream man." You know, just these kind of like, okay, like bring in the ice cream man. What are you talking about? I mean, are we worried about this? So that's where we are. So we're gonna talk about all that stuff. You know, I kind of feel like, you know, we've had a lot of crises recently. I kind of feel like this week is almost kind of low energy. All right? I mean, okay, sure, we have an impeachment trial, but, you know, relative to recent events, like, okay, you know, we can take that in stride. Anyway, remember that the Josh Marshall podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. It is New Orleans style. It is made from a special blend of 100% Arabica beans, French chicory, and signature spices brewed overnight to give you a velvety smooth cup you can drink iced, hot, or spiked in a cocktail. Treat yourself to a gourmet cup of coffee without stepping foot outside, all for less than $1 a cup. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. And remember, give it a try. Support our sponsors. That helps them out, helps us out, and everybody gets super happy. So, Dave and Kate, what's going on?
Hey, Josh. Well, I thought you had a pretty good good summation of where we are today as we kind of go into the first, I guess, the impeachment trial kind of starts in earnest today. Yesterday, the question was really centered around, is it constitutional to have an impeachment trial of a former president, kind of like you were laying out? And the Senate did vote, yes, it is. There was only one surprise Republican flip. That was Bill Cassidy, senator from Louisiana, who voted with this Rand Paul motion, I guess, last month, declaring the impeachment trial unconstitutional. But he flipped his vote and yesterday voted to continue with the trial, for it to move forward. No other Republicans had changed their vote from the last time around. And so, you know, even though the first day wasn't focused on kind of the actual arguments or laying out, you know, the 8 or 16 hours of arguments against Trump, but the Democrats did have a pretty effective presentation, I thought. And maybe we can start with just that 13-minute video that they opened with, which was very visceral and, you know, still jarring to see. I think there's so much kind of user-generated content and cable news flashes it, you know, throughout the day. We see it on Twitter. You get these kind of bits and pieces of footage of the chaos and the violence and the danger. But seeing it all kind of edited together, I thought made for an effective and emotionally kind of affecting opening for it. And then, you know, you had one of the Democratic House impeachment managers, Jamie Raskin, put it in very personal terms, talking about burying, you know, his son and then being at the Capitol with his, I think, daughter and son-in-law, and worried about, you know, losing other family members so soon after, you know, going through personal tragedy. And so I thought, you know, the video footage is obviously effective, and then kind of putting it in personal terms just really drove the point home. And then, you know, we got up to the next round with Bruce Castor and David Schoen, and Castor giving kind of this meandering speech. I think he summed up his whole presentation pretty well when he said, "Oh, I used to work in this building 40 years ago. I used to get lost then, and I still do now." And it's kind of like, well, yeah, I can see where that comes from. So I don't know, Kate, any other first impressions kind of from the first day, and then anything you can tell us about kind of what we might expect as things get going today?
Yeah, so what kind of struck me, the difference between this impeachment and impeachment round one, is that the underlying kind of thing we're fighting over here is just so much more emotional than it was last time. You know, the Capitol attack is something that everyone watched and, you know, has seen scenes of, and there are already pictures from it that are famous, you know, with Officer Goodman kind of like frozen in, you know, in that moment of panic when he like decided which way to lead the, you know, the mob. So that is something that struck me, because I think we all know how this impeachment's going to go. There's really not a lot of mystery here. Republicans have made it clear that there's no chance they're going to acquit him. So, you know, to some degree, you're almost like, well, this exercise is pointless. We all watch this unfold in real time. It's not like there's going to be a lot of new evidence, but you know, it was this unprecedented since the 19th century attack on, you know, the seat of our government. And that's the kind of thing that I think gets you emotional, even if you know that what happened and that it's coming. But seeing it sliced together like that, I think, moved people, you know, both inside and outside the chamber in ways they didn't expect. Like, we had all this color from reporters who were in the room, of, you know, senators covering their eyes or, you know, clutching their hearts. So, you know, the kind of, even though yesterday was about this constitutionality question, the emotional undertones here, I think, are just going to bleed through at every stage of this trial in a way that wasn't so true last time. I mean, last time Democrats were angry, but, you know, kind of the way he was strong-arming the Ukrainian president, it's just, it's a little different. It's more corruption-y. It's not so we took a shot to the heart of our government. And then today, we found out that they're going to show new footage, never before seen, of the Capitol attack that was taken from the security footage, you know, the cameras that are in place in the building. And some senior aides to the impeachment team said that it's going to show how close we came to even more extreme violence. And, you know, they said death. So I think kind of putting together those pieces, what we can expect to see today is footage that's going to show how close these people came to, you know, lawmakers, and aides and reporters. And so, you know, I think their curation of it today is really very pointed at, you know, making the Republican senator see these people were really, really close to you, and they probably would have hurt you if they got their hands on you. So, you know, impeachment team is still kind of doing this all-out push to persuade Republicans to come over to their side. They projected confidence this morning, talking about, you know, there's Cassidy. We see other signs of movement from Republicans. And, you know, end of the day, Trump is not going to get convicted. There's just no way there's going to be enough Republicans. But for Democrats, the key here is exact as much political pain as possible on the way to that acquittal. So they're going to keep strumming these very emotional heartstrings.
Is there any consensus or any sense of how, I mean, I would certainly think Romney will vote to convict. I mean, clearly right. He's crossed that river, right?
Yeah.
And
he did it the harder times. So.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know. I mean, are we thinking that like three or four might vote to convict? I mean, obviously that's not even remotely close to the number you'd need. But I will say that I don't think. Well, certainly not. Not. In, you know, in Trump's first impeachment or with Clinton, even getting majority, which seems, I think, almost a certainty at this point, although I guess, you know, Harris isn't there, so you could, in theory, get a tie. But in any case, do we have a sense of that? Is there people talking about that, or we just have no idea?
Well, I think people keep pointing to these constitutionality votes as the roadmap where we've seen, what, 5, 6 with Cassidy, maybe. So that seems to me to be like the ceiling. And then the floor being, yeah, you know, alone Romney. Even though, I mean, it's the usual suspects. You know, Murkowski was pissed after yesterday. Collins was perplexed, I'd say is the word. So, yeah, I think handful at most. But to me, it just seems if you're not going to take, if you're not going to vote that it's constitutional, which is the easier of the two votes, you know, it seems
yeah,
that
it
you wouldn't be summoning your
sense.
Courage for
yeah.
The other.
Yeah, at all. Although it also, I mean, it's just weird because that constitutional argument is so absurd.
Yeah.
That, you know.
Well, and it also, I think, kind of it highlights, you know, Ted Cruz's comment on the way out of the chamber yesterday was, basically, the president's lawyers didn't do a very good job. And then he praised Jamie Raskin as a serious lawyer, which I thought was so funny because the implication of he's a serious lawyer vis-a-vis Trump's lawyers who are not serious lawyers. Nonetheless, Cruz voted that the trial is unconstitutional. You know, so it's like they're almost not even really pretending to buy into the arguments at this point. It's more of a, you know where I'm going to come down. I know where I'm going to come down. Let's just get
yeah,
this done.
I guess the constitutionality question gives them cover, as kind of lame and weak as that argument is, that, oh, well, we just don't believe it's constitutional in the first place. So why would I vote to convict Trump? And I think, Josh, you're probably right that there's maybe a handful of Republican senators who might come around to it, the usual suspects that we've talked about. One thing I can't quite get my head around is the kind of PR push maybe behind the scenes of Mitch McConnell. You know, he had that leak to the New York Times. I guess this was like kind of late last year, maybe early this year, saying that, oh, he was so mad at Trump, and he was open to, you know, he wanted the impeachment process to go forward. And then he's basically just kind of turned around and defended Trump at every turn. Yesterday, he voted against the constitutionality of the impeachment trial. And then there was yet another leak, I guess, to Bloomberg this time, that he hasn't made up his mind yet on which way he'll vote, and that he's signaling to Republican colleagues, this is a vote of conscience and, like, you know, vote your heart, you know. But I just can't see any scenario where McConnell turns around and convicts Trump. So I just don't quite get what that PR push behind the scenes is really about.
Of, like, virtue signaling.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it I could see where he may think it keeps keeps Trump a little on his best behavior, you know, just to keep a touch of uncertainty, doesn't hurt him. And it's again in that at least the version of it I saw to Bloomberg, it's, you know, something like, you know, telling associates he may vote, you know, like, wow, that's pretty right. Tenuous, right? I don't think you're going to have, you know, a bunch of Trump insurgents like surrounding his house and saying, you told Bloomberg you may consider, you know, you told associates you may consider voting possibly to impeach. Fuck that. We're going to burn your house down. You know, so you can have it kind of both ways. I mean, something you mentioned, Kate, and I've been wondering about this, when we were going to see the first closed caption, you know, surveillance tapes, because unsurprisingly, that complex is lousy with security cameras, right? I mean, there are security cameras everywhere. So they basically must have, you know, I mean, every moment of everything. If anything, that almost, you know, there's a separate issue of their apparently the holdup in trying to indict someone for the murder of Officer Sicknick is, at least according to the, you know, to the leaks out of the investigation, they're having a hard time pinpointing when he sustained the injury that later killed him. And obviously, if you can't pinpoint the when the injury happened, you can't blame it on someone because you don't know who did it. And one of the things that has been, you know, one of the oddities about that death that has been sort of hanging out there about it is that apparently he was, you know, relatively okay after sustaining the injury, whatever the injury was, goes back to, like, you know, the headquarters of the Capitol Police and collapses, and then he subsequently dies. So it's possible that it's certainly possible that he had several sort of violent encounters, and it's just not clear which one, you know, was a mortal injury. But yeah, I mean, there's just so much we have. I mean, again, as far as I know, we have yet to have any press conference. I mean, we had that one that the U.S. attorney in D.C. did, but we haven't really had more than that about just, okay, what have you found out? What's the, you know, kind of none of that, which is
very shocking,
which is very, very strange. And it's no longer at the point where you can say, well, you know, Mitch is keeping it bottled up or Trump won't let him do it. I mean, places run by Democrats now. And I assume that one of the main reasons we're not seeing the closed caption TV is that obviously, you know, criminal investigators want to keep everything bottled up for obvious reasons. But it's one of those things about Congress that's their place. They run it. They don't have to talk to the attorney general. They don't have to talk to anybody. It's their place. So basically, depending, I don't know exactly, you know, what the distribution is between, you know, the leadership of the House and the Senate, but they're all Democrats. So Pelosi can just say, print it, show it, you know, and they have both a political legal rationale in that they're doing this trial and it's obviously highly relevant. But I would imagine you just want people to see what happened. Because it's shocking. It remains absolutely shocking.
And I think the lack of details that you're talking about and kind of the lack of any seeming compulsion for these people to let the public in on what happened is almost kind of compounding the trauma, because we just like don't know what caused this violence, you know. And it's also led to, there's been like very little talk of the two officers who committed suicide in the wake of the attack, you know. And I think it was this big traumatic thing for people who were there, for people who watched it, for everyone. And it's kind of clouded in this hail of, we don't know anything, we don't know any details. And you know, I wonder, I don't even know if that kind of stuff is going to even come out in this trial, because all the groups involved have been so, you know, so tight-lipped.
Well, isn't there, I mean, there was at least some reporting that federal prosecutors are considering a RICO prosecution, and that is this law that was designed to deal with the mafia. But the idea is that it allows prosecutors to get, you know, to reach beyond the individual who did the specific crime and say, you were part of a criminal organization. We are going to hold the organization responsible for your crime, for being a criminal organization, and the application of that to the mafia, sometimes to organized crime with drugs, blah, 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 you know, pretty straightforward. But, you know, one of the things, aside from what may be relevant in a criminal, you know, criminal trial context, one of the things I'm most interested in is that it's clear that you've got a core of people who were there that day to go and storm the Capitol. That was what they wanted to do. Still a little unclear about what their, you know, kind of ultimate aim was, whether it's to sort of, you know, intimidate, to kidnap, whatever. But kind of they go in with a very specific plan. And there's seems to be some evidentiary trail about the actual planning to do that. Then you clearly have a larger penumbra of people who kind of know things are going to get rowdy, and maybe they know, maybe they're thinking of what happened in Michigan in April, where a bunch of, and I actually did a post about this today, these things are clearly deeply connected in terms of the sort of the norm busting, the permissioning structure of all of this. But in any case, some people kind of like are there for whatever happens and want to kind of be rowdy and do whatever. But and this isn't exonerating those people, but there's different levels of planning, right? And I would imagine there are some people that kind of didn't quite know what to expect when they went over to the Capitol. But as soon as people started rushing in, they're up for it. And so I'm very interested in the interplay to the extent that it can be sussed out between those different groups. And again, that would be the kind of thing that one imagines might come out in a RICO prosecution, because you have to, the way that works is you would have to say, like, let's just say hypothetically, it's the Proud Boys they're going after. You have to say, look, Proud Boys is an organization, it has membership, it has all these different kind of things. It counts as an organization for the purposes of RICO. The key people did this, that, and the other. But again, it is very weird that we're even at this point, and let alone we don't know all the details, again, one press conference. There's just very little. And, you know, in some ways, it's probably not too soon to remember the point about the Mueller investigation, which is to say that, you know, criminal prosecutions, the point of a criminal prosecution is to prosecute an individual person and punish them. It's not to give you the full story as the public about what happened. So I think we need, and you know, maybe this would get folded into a larger kind of Trump commission or something like that. But we need some kind of commission to sort of tell this story. And as far as I know, there's been no move to create that.
Yeah, that's been mentioned a few times. Pelosi especially has said it a bunch. But yeah, I don't recall at least hearing anything about you know, more solid than that, more solid than the we need something like a 9/11 commission type thing.
Yeah. Let me ask you just about the kind of timing and strategy of the trial, which is, I think Republicans and Democrats alike don't want this to take up too much time. Republicans for obvious reasons, and Democrats, I guess, also, you know, Biden has been pretty tight-lipped about the process. Whenever he's asked about impeachment, he's basically responds by saying, I've got a job to do. I'm worried about Americans going hungry and the COVID relief package and getting people back to work and all that. And the Senate can kind of handle its own business. By all accounts, this will probably be wrapped up by, you know, Saturday evening, potentially. So it will be not even a full week. That's assuming that there aren't witnesses, which seems, like you said, Josh, to be kind of, you know, what the consensus is or how we're all assuming the trial will play out. Do you feel like, is that enough attention for the, you know, the span of the trial? Is there, an advantage to dragging it out a bit by calling witnesses, to keeping the pressure on Republicans, or really, you know, kind of trying to have an accounting of what actually happened in the riot? And Kate, I'm curious to get your thoughts too.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Josh said is right, that we need a much more thorough accounting of what happened, but I also think that's not going to happen in this trial. And that being said, you know, kind of the theme of our pod since the Biden administration began is that there's a really truncated timeline for when they're going to be able to be legislatively effective. And so, you know, that's top of mind for Democrats. And it's not like there really is any Republican pressure or any pressure on the Republicans. I mean, obviously, this is making them look bad to people who care about the insurrection and think it was a bad thing and think it, you know, Trump was responsible. But even opinions on that are so baked in. And we've seen from, you know, Senate Republicans' response to Trump all along is that the political impetus is for them to stick to his side. So in that way, there's not really that much pressure. Democrats know that if they want the Biden administration to be successful, there's only a few months in which to do that. So, yeah, I think the fast timeline kind of makes sense. Both sides want it, so it'll probably happen. And on the witness question, I almost feel like these videos they've been showing are kind of standing in for having people testify, because this is what they would testify to, but you get to watch it and experience it. And that's probably even more emotional kind of compared to what we saw last time, where we had, you know, Vindman and Hill and these people testify. You know, a piece of that is that you need these people to be articulate and good public speakers and to have good stage presence and all these other things that career civil servants don't necessarily have, you know? So this is a way where they can control the narrative with this video footage. It's very emotional and you don't really have to worry about the messenger.
Yeah, it's a good point. It speaks for itself, kind of.
I mean, to the extent that they had more details on, you know, this person had a gun and this person got here, and I guess that's sort of what they're going to get into with this video today. But to the extent that they could do those could potentially be interesting testimony. But it's hard for me to imagine testimony that would be more compelling or tell us more than what we saw happen in real time and what we have seen sort of embroidered over time in more examples of video coming forward. I mean, who would testify and what would they say? I mean, maybe you could get the girlfriend. I believe they were not married, you know, the girlfriend of the officer who died. That would be very, you know, pretty intense. I'm not sure what would move the ball, and frankly, there's nothing stopping Democrats in either chamber for doing, which I think they should, hearings, you know, doing an investigation about that. And my sense through this whole thing has been, you know, great if there are some, you know, if there are some witnesses that are actually going to kind of expand on the story, but anything that is going to meaningfully slow down getting the COVID relief package done or any of the sort of the, you know, kind of related important things, I'd say no. because that's important. That's really important. And so get this done with, move through it. But I don't see any reason to delay things unless, again, there's some testimony, not clear to me what it would be, that is just such a big deal, you have to do it. That's the priority. The priority is the relief bill.
Yeah. And, you know, DT, you also mentioned that Biden has been very reticent on the impeachment trial. I just want to say, I think that's exactly what he should be doing. He doesn't have really anything to do with it. And the only thing that him weighing in does is kind of strengthen the bad faith arguments that this is a partisan spectacle and, you know, just a way to punish a hated president kind of thing. And, you know, meanwhile, I know we talk a lot about bipartisan and unity being used as cudgels by Republicans against Democrats doing things they don't like. But, you know, he does have an interest in getting things done in a bipartisan way. And I think the more he kind of stays out of this very emotional and raw fray and deals on the legislative side with things, or, you know, the influence he can have on the legislative things is, you know, exactly the lane that he should be in.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, maybe we can spend just the last few minutes we have in this episode talking about kind of a related issue, which is just a growing swell of Republican retirements. Was it just earlier this week, Kate, you wrote up Richard Shelby, senator from Alabama, announcing that he won't run for re-election? I think Shelby is in his 80s, I want to say. Is that right?
Yeah, he's 86.
Yeah, 86, so understandable. Rob Portman, who's quite a bit younger, not a young man by any means, but young in Senate terms, is also not running for re-election. You know, is there, what's behind this?
I think if you're in the Senate, if you're under 70, you're like a young gun.
Exactly, right? an up-and-comer, yeah, a rising star. I don't know, Kate, do you have any sense of what's driving this? Is it, it's not fun kind of being in the minority, and there are a lot of open Republican seats in 2022, so it doesn't seem like Republicans' chances of taking back the Senate are especially high, although they could flip the House in the next midterms, but what's behind this recent kind of wave of retirements?
Well, the interesting thing about that is, historically speaking, Republicans should win one, if not both, chambers this cycle, just because of the historical precedent of, you know, the last four times a president has gone in with both chambers of his same party, he has lost one of them in the midterms. So it's not, you know, the retirements are interesting because it's not like they're facing a year that is going to be a Republican bloodbath. You know, we don't know that at all. And the retirements have actually made for a much more competitive battleground for Democrats, because so far we've also seen Pat Toomey and Richard Burr announce their retirements, opening up seats in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, you know, which are not Republican locks by any means. You know, Portman is the only one who's been fairly candid about his retirement, or perhaps the most candid. He said that, you know, it's just become so hard in this hyper-polarized time to get anything through the Senate that, you know, he wants out, essentially. Shelby, you know, makes a little more sense. He's very old. That being said, though, he has been either the chairman or ranking member on the Appropriations Committee for years, which is a very powerful position. And while I don't think an open Alabama seat is exactly the same grounds for contest as, say, an open Pennsylvania seat, despite Doug Jones's surprise win in 2017, the point of all of this is for Democrats, the more Republican incumbents who bow out and who turn their seats from safe Republican holds to any kind of competition, anything Republicans will have to spend money and resources on to defend, that's a good thing for Democrats. Especially given, like you said, DT, that right now Democrats only have a 5-seat majority in the House, which is very tenuous. The campaign arm of the National Republicans on the House side put out a list of their targets today, the seats that they're going after, either due to, they've broken them up into different segments. But one segment of that is all about redistricting, which is going to be a huge Democratic concern as we're going on, because down ballot, Democrats didn't do that well in a lot of states, giving Republican state legislatures control over the redistricting process, which is going to make it even more of an uphill battle to hold the House. So, yeah, the retirements on the Senate side are nothing but good for Democrats right now. And, you know, they might not be at an end. There's been speculation that now Ron Johnson from Wisconsin is the most vulnerable member in the chamber, that he might call it quits.
I think I saw you tweet that maybe. I was stunned. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that was considered to be on the radar at all.
Johnson?
I mean, just, yeah, yeah. I mean, he, you know, he seems to like being a jerk in the Senate, you know, and, you know, it was, I mean, both of his elections have been shocking. It was shocking when he won the first time.
He ran against Feingold in 2016. Is that right?
Yeah, and that was really shocking. Everybody's sense was kind of like, okay, he came in on 2014 and kind of, you know, beat Feingold, and now Feingold's going to come back and kind of, you know, in a better year. And obviously, Trump's going to destroy the Republican Party, and no Republican's going to win. Blah 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 blah. And he won. Right? It was like really, I mean, shocking and really kind of heartbreaking for a lot of us, especially because. A lot of people, you know, for many people, Russ Feingold wasn't just any senator, right? He was kind of an important person. But that's interesting. I mean, if that would be amazing if he, I mean, it's funny. I almost wonder what Democrats prefer, you know, the people at the Senate committee. Do they want to run against him again? Because I mean, man, he is highly polarizing. He really is a get out the Democrats person. But obviously he does have the inherent powers of incumbency. Or do you want Republicans to, I was going to say, you know, kind of have some normal kind of person. Well, that's not going to happen. But you can at least have someone who doesn't have the track record. You know, you have someone who just kind of comes in, some kind of, you know, sort of like Johnson was, CEO, going to run government like a business type, and can kind of, you know, not have Johnson's baggage. Anyway, that's fascinating to me, you know, that's possible.
And it shows their mindset, too, that, you know, if we were just looking at a Shelby retirement, he's 86, his seat is in Alabama, it's a safe Republican hold. You could be like, well, you know, he's been in there forever. But the fact that we're having people either retiring or considering retiring in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin that are going to be real fights either way kind of shows that these people who, you know, were part of the Republican Party pre-Trump and who are generally considered to be more creatures of the institution are still kind of prioritizing their own exit ramp over, you know, making this seat a safer hold for the party in a evenly split Senate.
It is interesting to me that it doesn't seem at all impossible that the Democrats could lose the House. I mean, if for nothing else, I mean, depending on how redistricting goes, it could be a situation where, like, it's almost impossible for them to hold it just because of the way the districts are drawn. So a scenario where, you know, even if it's not like a blowout, you know, Republicans get a 10-seat majority, something like that, just, you know, almost purely on the basis of redistricting. But Democrats expand and maybe even significantly expand their Senate majority at the same time. That does not seem, I mean, because again, there are a number of open seats in states that are not, you know, not Alabama, not Wyoming, places that have, you know, are very purple, you know, certainly at the state level, notwithstanding what happened, you know, the very disappointing Senate race that they just had in North Carolina. That's not a lock. Pennsylvania, that's not a lock at all. And with John Fetterman, I think that...
Yeah, big John Fetterman entering the race.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's
come on the pod, please.
Yeah, that looks pretty good. But I will say too, it's just, these are not normal times. And it's certainly entirely possible that, you know, things don't go great the next 2 years, and there's, you know, you have all of the you know, anti-incumbency stuff really hurts the Democrats. But I also think that, you know, coming off everything that has happened in the last 2 or 3 years, it's not clear to me that it's a given that Democrats are going to have a hard midterm election. We just don't know. There's many more variables that just, you know, you don't normally have to figure on.
Right. Plus, there's also the more traditional variables of, like, you know, how strong is the Biden presidency, which obviously is all tied up with, you know, the filibuster in the Senate and everything else. But, you know, how much stuff can they pass to run on will be part of this as well. And it's funny, something you mentioned, Josh, when we think of this, but I've been doing reporting the last couple of days about Ohio particularly, which, you know, Trump won in 2016 and 2020, which has kind of made people write it off as a swing state, say, you know, it's not the bellwether it once was. Anyway, I've been talking to a lot of people who have traced the political history in the state, and it is a little more complicated than just that it's not a swing state anymore. There have been pretty significant Democratic droughts there before, and Democrats have come back from them, despite the fact that there are Republican trends in the state and things that are kind of making Democrats more competitive in other states and that have turned, say, you know, Virginia and Colorado into blue states, is especially this Democratic lean of the suburbs. And in Ohio, that shift is not happening quite as much. And the red parts of Ohio are getting a lot redder and the city populations are dwindling. So you don't really have that balanced out. But something I talked to a lot of people about was, would you, for a Democrat, would you rather have a kind of more nutty Republican, a Jim Jordan, someone on the right fringe, would you rather have that person be the person that the Democrat is running against for the Portman seat? And they pretty much all gave me the same answer, which is usually, yeah, but now I'm too scared that that person could win, you know, and that's the gamble that you take. Maybe someone who's easier for the Democrat to beat, but maybe someone who's kind of a lunatic winning the seat and becoming a senator.
What do the people you talk to, what do they think about Tim? It's Tim Ryan, right?
Yeah.
The you know, because he's this guy, he's been sort of some, you know, kind of often not liked by progressives in D.C. I think he challenged Pelosi a couple times. But he seems like a really good fit for that race. He kind of has that, you know, he has a strong union background, you know, at least a state where the sort of the image of trade unionism is still heavily kind of, you know, male industrial workers and stuff like that. So it kind of seems to me if anybody you'd want to run, it would be someone like that who has some sort of cultural, you know, cultural adjacency to Trumpism, at least, you know, kind of presentationally, but also is a Democrat, D right. after his name. And, you know, even if he's not someone that the sort of progressive caucus in the House is crazy about, you know, not a bad addition to the Senate. Do people?
Yeah, I would say that the people I talked to would pretty much, there's definitely some wry chuckling about him just because he has been very ambitious for a long time. So kind of in the way of, well, it was a matter of time before he was going to go for this. You know, he ran for president in 2020, right, which I think some people forget. But, yeah. You know,
it was pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing about him is, in some ways, I think you're right. Like, it seems he is a good fit. And for Democrats who are trying to replicate Sherrod Brown's kind of singular success in the state among this Democratic drought, you know, you think, okay, white guy who, if he can maybe speak the language of economic populism, that's something that seems to have united Ohioans behind both Brown and Trump to some degree. But, you know, the other thing I kept hearing is that people were saying that with some criticism of the Ohio State Democratic Party, that they keep trotting out the same people and it keeps not working. And one person compared it to Michigan in 2018, where Democrats performed really well. And he was telling me the difference between here and Michigan in 2018 is that in Michigan, everyone who ran was either a woman or an African-American man, and they all won. And in Ohio, we put up this slate of old white men who everybody's seen before, who everyone knew before, who weren't exciting. So I have seen kind of a lot of arguments in favor of picking someone who would galvanize Ohio Democrats, maybe more, even more so than picking someone like Ryan, who would maybe be seen as kind of a safer, more generally appealing person. Like, you also, Nan Whaley keeps coming up. She's the mayor of Dayton, who's gotten some national coverage from a tornado, I guess, and a shooting kind of hitting back to back there. And then you have Amelia Sykes, who is this young Black woman who's the minority leader of the House of Representatives. And, you know, another theme that that kept coming up over and over again is people saying that Democrats in Ohio are doing a terrible job of reaching out to the Black community specifically and are kind of stuck in this entrenched model of Ohio politics, which is like, Democrats are only going to get votes from the unions, and that's what you need to appeal to, this kind of like older white blue collar version of Democrats at the expense of especially Black communities, especially urban communities. You know, because Trump actually raised his vote share in the cities in Ohio from 2016 to 2020. So, and you know, that being said, the Biden campaign did not really compete in Ohio. They didn't even formally set up shop until August, September. So, you know, they clearly saw easier routes to the White House, which I think was, you know, a good decision in retrospect. But the party apparatus is rusty. Ohio as it is a hard, large, very regionalized state. If you look at all the other states it borders, it's like one corner is totally different from another. And it's really expensive. It's cloaked in media markets that you have to compete in. So
there's let me just add one last thing here. And because I think a lot of people think about, well, okay, you know, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, kind of, you know, these Rust Belt states. What, at least, you know, people who are there know this, but what I think people forget, Ohio is an Appalachian state. Sure, not like up in the north, but it is, big parts of it are basically an Appalachian state, which is to say it has much more similarity to, you know, kind of Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia than it does these, you know, Great Lakes states. So that's one thing that I think the comparison to Michigan, obviously Michigan's got a pretty wild Republican Party. We've seen that a lot, just even in recent days. But it's different. It's not just another kind of like a different version of Wisconsin and Illinois and Michigan. So that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. I talked to Sherrod Brown's longtime pollster, and the way she put it is, it would be a mistake to compare Ohio to Michigan or Kentucky, but there are parts of it that are just like both of those states.
Right.
So it's just so intensely regionalized. You have to have this really broad appeal to a lot of different people. And that's just, you know, that's been a roadblock to Democrats for like the past 10 years there.
Right. All right. Well, I think we should leave it there. I've got impeachment starting up and lots to get to still. But we should come back to this next week and talk, you know, maybe there will be more retirements we can talk about or more candidates in the mix. But Kate, that was really helpful to hear all that context. So thank you for sharing all that.
Yeah. Remember, the Josh Marshall podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. If you're ready to give it a try, you can get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. All right.
See you next week.
Later,
folks.
See you
guys.
Bye.